Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, March 3rd, 2012. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is the title of what we're all, I hope, doing today. It's an International Day of Action, mobilizing to stop the drive for World War III and to instead promote humanity. Now, I couldn't think of any more welcome and perfect guest for today than someone who's involved in activating in this way in our world battle. And because it's happenstance that we're able to have him live here in our studio, but he's from Ireland, and I'm very happy to welcome Gene Douglas. Welcome, Gene.
Thank you very much, Marcia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, good. And Gene is a patriot of his own homeland. As I said, he's from Ireland. And he is a leader and founder of an effort called the LaRouche Irish Brigade. He'll be telling us about this as much or as little as he wants to, in the sense formally. There's a website, there's a whole policy drive, which we'll be getting into. And Gene also, as I say, he's live in the studio. He's been operating transatlantic for a bit here physically because he was in Berlin, Germany, February 25 and 26, where he attended an international conference that brought close to 200 people together, similar, different, but, you know, as Gene, from, what, Gene, about 22 countries or something?
Yeah, yes, I think about 22 countries, and the only absentees were the French, and that was, of course, for, you know, the best of reasons, in that they were working hard on Jacques Chaminade's campaign and working towards a victory there, hopefully. So.
Right. So it was a tremendous turnout of a policy turnout, too, given the what was the panels presented, which, as I say, we'll get into. And I just want to say in advance a couple of things for people to know, and then we'll dive into the many things that Gene has to say and knows about. But the when I contrast this Berlin conference that took place, Gene, I can't remember the exact title, but I think it was Rescuing Mankind.
Yes, Rescuing Mankind was basically the title and the subject of the conference, an excellent title.
Right, and the reason I mention that is, in contrast, within about 6 days, 25 heads of state of Europe got together, including from Ireland, of course, in Brussels, and they had a conference on the opposite point, which was, namely, they, in the false name of in empire speak, they were discussing how to have stability, but they were discussing and agreeing to a pact on how to ruin nations and peoples. We're going to get into that. That was March 1st, the night of March 1st, they were all meeting. So, in fact, we're at a very critical point in policy in the world, because we're at the dead end, final phase of this world, decades of globalization, something best called British Empire policies for the world, not because it's the English people, but because it's City of London financial interests. And we have the war threat upon us because the same interests are instigating the threat of war if they don't get their way with imposing these ferocious austerity and killer policies on the world, like this Brussels meeting March 1st. And that's so today, March 3rd, I hope everyone, some of you listen days or weeks later, but I hope there's the maximum involvement, because it just won't be one day, March 3rd, for bringing out to the, making it known to the general or very specialized parts of the world population that this has got to stop. The stakes involved are for mankind. We're either going to have a future and for humanity, or its empire, and it's going to be doom, either an all-out war or some variation on that. And I'll just say, we're not going to go into it on the show, but there are actions on every continent. I know Melbourne, Australia has been lively for at least 2 days. the Germany has met Dresden, Berlin, Frankfurt, many, many towns all across the United States. We've had action. I would like to point out to all of the activists listening in the United States that on Friday, that would be yesterday, March 2nd, we had teams ring around Washington, D.C., to get everyone before they sneaked away for the weekend and not let it and make it known. We had leaflets distributed. Helga Zepp LaRouche has written one, part of the National LaRouche slate of six. Keisha Rogers wrote a call to action. And these were distributed in all of the infamous sites in Washington, D.C., Foggy Bottom near Capitol Hill, and all of the outer sites near the Pentagon, where you have all of the contractors and the civilian employees. So I just want to say everyone's individual action, wherever you may be, is part of a kind of activation of weak forces, that you could call them in physics, in science, like what the elemental forces on the subatomic level. But that's the forces that are going to change it, and it really will count, so people should be active. So with that said, and also that Mr. LaRouche has written a new paper that's either posted or will be on populism and principle, namely support principle and don't fall for populism, and that's something that people can make a point of reading on our EIR online site, which is LaRouchePub.com, where you're listening, or go to his political action committee, LaRouchePAC.com. So with that, what I thought is... I want to, Jean, you, one of the things is you have a website you can tell people about and when you set it up as a policy driver in Ireland. And then secondly, along with that, there is a wonderful paper that appears there. It's a programmatic document from last October called it's an economic plan. I think you call it an economic revival plan, right?
Yes.
And would you begin by talking about that?
Sure. Well, we set the website up just a short couple of months ago, actually, just before Christmas. And the idea of it really at that time was just to share information amongst ourselves in Ireland. There were, you know, a number of people interested in LaRouche and in the LaRouche movement, and you know, we had begun to collaborate, and we actually thought that this website would be just a convenient way to share information between ourselves. But since that point, you know, we have discovered that it has received quite a few views, and that has been steadily growing. So we have been using it, you know, as a proper website to, you know, put forward our plans and our proposals within the Irish LaRouche movement and the broader LPAC movement. And as I said, the views have been increasing. The website is called LaRoucheIrishBrigade.wordpress.com. It's quite a long title, but I think if people want to find it, they can just search for LaRouche Irish Brigade. That should find it for them.
Right, and before the show, I'll repeat it again. As you said, LaRouche Irish Brigade dot WordPress dot one word, WordPress.com. Anyway, yes. So that was about December.
Yes, it was just before Christmas that we really set it up. As I say, the initial reason for setting it up was to share a paper, a brief paper that we wrote called Ireland and Economic Revival. We wrote that in October of last year, and really it was prompted by Mr. LaRouche's direction that nations should look towards the Arctic as the key for economic development and a revival of the general world economy. So, you know, following Mr. LaRouche's lead, we decided that, Ireland has to get involved in this. Ireland has to look at physical economic development as other nations must as well. And, So we thought a little bit about how we could make that happen, or produce proposals for that to happen. And of course, we looked. All we had to do really was look west, and we have the vast Atlantic Ocean right out there. And of course, Ireland as an island nation. The ocean, the sea around us offers great potential. Even more so now, because fairly recently, under the Law of the Sea Convention, Ireland has been granted sovereign control of a huge area of the Atlantic around our coast. It actually amounts to some 220 million acres.
And if you compare that to Ireland, yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. The land area itself of Ireland is around a tenth of that, around 21 million acres. So, we have this vast area now, 10 times the land area, and it's available to us for, exploration, exploitation of resources and so forth, and it offers great potential basically for the future, and it's something that we have incorporated into this economic revival paper, and we hope that it's that is taken seriously and followed up on.
Right. It was one thing interesting to think about is all the studies that can go on that have insights into life, into medicine, into possibilities for space, other planets. You have these geothermal vents, I understand, in the mid-Atlantic. I think the general public, like myself, thinks of the studies done in the southwestern Pacific with those geothermal vents.
Yes.
But Ireland has been involved in these studies, and there's a tremendous frontier here.
Yes, exactly. I think it's one avenue that Ireland should pursue. As a science driver of economy. The field of astrobiology is very interesting, very very relative to our exploration further beyond this planet into the solar system. For example, the find in Lake Mono in California, which we refer to in the paper, there was a discovery of creatures there that use arsenic actually in part as part of their physical processes, and it indicates that what we thought we knew about life, it's changing all the time. So with new discoveries like that, it will have great application, as we explore further into space and hopefully in the not too distant future look at some of these other planets in the solar system.
Right, and I understand even as late, I think you mentioned 2003, there was an Irish research, deep sea research boat that was able to be, to carry on and conduct this kind of research, that if you'd had the funding continue and so forth, you would be, despite the worsening imperial end of the old speculative kind of world casino system, we still have these capabilities that could be resumed and expanded very fast. And the other thing is, you may want to say more about that Deep Sea Frontier Initiative, I think that's what you called it. But there are other aspects of what's obvious about the economic revival future, and that is marine shipping activity of all kind, not just research, given your geolocation to the Northern Passage, given your... And a lot of the shipping interests in Ireland have been wanting to do this for years. Right?
Well, exactly. Historically, as an island nation, clearly, the economy of Ireland in the past has been, connected in a very significant way with all sorts of marine activity.
Yeah, I think you have those famous historic. Please excuse me, I can't remember the name either in Welsh or in any Celtic or Irish. Those floating baskets that went across the Atlantic.
Oh yes, the coracles.
Yes, coracles. Thank you.
Yeah, the old vessels.
Yes.
Yes, and you know we've come some way from that in terms of technology now, but
it's in your heritage.
It is in the heritage, you know. And a good example is comes from McManus's book. You know, when he talks about at the beginning of the 19th century that. Mm-hmm. You know, Ireland had a very substantial marine fleet, and actually, you know, 150,000 men operating from 27,000 vessels. Wow. Around the coast. So, you know, obviously some of those were small fishing vessels and so forth, but it's quite a significant, actually those are quite significant figures, and of course that... In subsequent years and decades, that was totally suppressed by the British, who were envious of this aspect of Irish sea power.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, we think that Ireland, you know, should look to return to that seafaring heritage. And at the minute, you know, most of our imports in terms of all sorts of goods, commodities and so forth, is through Britain. And we think that there's no reason at all that, you know, that Ireland can't import directly. And in fact, we should be doing so in our own ships, we think, as well. The opening of the North Sea route, you know, has enormous potential not only for the Arctic nations.
You mean like the far north, northern? Mm-hmm.
The far north, the northern mm-hmm. sea route is mm-hmm. Is the route through the Arctic Ocean along the coast of Siberia, basically offering a passage from the Pacific right round to the Atlantic. And it's something that the Russians, Vladimir Putin, has announced fairly recently that the Russians have the intention of fully opening that and, you know, making it a main transport artery for shipping from Asia, from Russia, round to Europe and beyond. And I think, you know, Ireland has an ideal location right at the end of that particular route. We should look to capitalize on that and, you know, just play our part in this this great potential that the Arctic development offers. I think it is something that is necessary, actually, to reboot the whole world economy. And, you know, as I say, it's something that we can play a part in and a positive, constructive part. In cooperation with other nations, of course. You know, I think the idea of, you know, economic competition between nations is something that is outdated, and you know, we need to look at genuine cooperation, in these kind of matters in the future.
Right. Let me just interpose here for our listeners. One thing that's been implicit all along, I'm just going to make it explicit, and then, Gene, I want to get back to this, is what you say about Vladimir Putin having said or committed to this northern passage for the... and I think he was saying, you quote in your paper, you give the quotes, that we want to make it secure, we want to make it... keep it open. You know, that means icebreakers. And that points up the election... tomorrow, March 4th, in Russia, and that in fact this is an election that's part of a world strategic decision point, where what the leadership Mr. Putin is representing for world collaboration and development is what's at stake, not this British Empire policy of competition and war, and in fact they've tried to intervene and denounce and mess up and do everything possible in the Russian elections. That's not our topic today, but that's why we're beginning with discussing economic policy in the world on a day when we're having an action to prevent, to stop the drive toward World War III. It's all the one same package. And
exactly.
And in that regard, back to, though, your report that you're giving here, the last few days it was announced in Russia, maybe by Mr. Putin himself or someone else, that they're opening this summer in August the first Arctic special rescue, it's like a fire department in the Arctic, capability. And it's going to be one of 10, because you want to set these up so if a ship does get in trouble, you can get there fast. Just like was done in the Southern Pole in the Antarctic, there was a fire in a Brazilian facility. I can't remember. It might have been a research facility, power facility. And I think the Chileans or someone else were able to come to the rescue. So the Russians are making good on it. They're going to open up the and this is directly what you're saying about the geostrategic location of Ireland. That's what it's part of.
Yes, exactly. You know, the political will is there and the intention is clear from the Russians and the Chinese, I would say, and some other nations there as well. But the what the Russians have done has signaled very clearly that, you know, that they have this intention that and they will fulfill it to open this northern sea route. You know, which will actually turn world trade really on its head. As most people are probably aware, currently the bulk of sea trade goes through the Suez Canal and what's called the Southern Sea Route, the Straits of Malacca and so forth, past Singapore. Sometimes larger vessels have to go around the very point of Africa. And, you know, so the Northern Sea Route offers a much shorter and more efficient route from, you know, Asia, China, I suppose, in particular, which is the main manufacturing centre now, really, in the world, through to the markets in Europe. I think it's something that will be irresistible to, you know, both the national fleets and commercial fleets, you know, they will find it of great value to look at the Northern Sea Route and to use that extensively in the future. So yes, as I say, I think, you know, Ireland can play a significant part in this, alongside the other nations who are possibly more, you know, more thought of as Arctic nations, such as Norway, Iceland, so forth. Even Scotland is very interested now in joining this kind of alliance, and so we think the prospects are you know, excellent for the future. We have a facility in on the west of the Irish coast, a deep water inlet known as the Shannon Estuary, and there is some port facility there at the minute, but we think that really it can be enhanced, you know, hugely, and really can become what we call a super port, you know, on the scale of Shanghai or Rotterdam, to handle, you know, this trade, which, you know, if we manage to, you know, avoid this threat of World War III and get the world economy back on its feet and flourishing again with things like the Arctic development, the increase in trade is going to be, you know, phenomenal, I think. And as I say, I think that's one of the key areas where Ireland can make a contribution.
Yeah, well, one thing I would just, before the show, I thought I'd look at the map again to be sure of my memory. And people know there are famous estuaries and bays in our Galway Bay. I mean, they're legendary, right? But I didn't appreciate that Shannon is the longest river in all of the British Isles. I'm calling it Britain because
yes,
it's an expression,
okay.
Right? But
sure.
A geographic from the old maps.
Yeah.
And that's not the point. The estuary is good. But could you run through if you were – the thing is the link to then get to the mainland of Eurasia has been thought about, right, involving tunnels and so forth. Do you want to describe if you were going from the superport of Shannon eastward to connect all the way into Eurasia, how that would work?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, if we look at the proposals that have been on the table for a long time now, proposals made, you know, initially by Lyndon and Helga LaRouche for a world land bridge of high-speed leading-edge maglev rail. That's exactly what we are looking towards in Ireland as well, to connect up, and we can do that quite readily, I believe, through the possibility of two tunnels, and I think both should be pursued. From the north of Ireland across to Scotland, which is a pretty short crossing in terms of distance, although the water is quite deep there.
But what do they call that, by the way, just for, or what's that link called?
Well, at the minute, it's just a ferry link, which is Lorne Stranraer ferry link.
Okay.
There is no specific name, as far as I'm aware, for a tunnel proposal. But the other option, or the second option, is for a tunnel from Wexford in the southeast of Ireland across to Pembrokeshire in Wales, and that has been thought about, you know, quite a lot in, you know, over recent years. Actually, come back to 2004 when the Institute or Academy of Engineers in Ireland wrote a paper looking towards the future of transport in Ireland by 2050. They had proposals for such a link, an undersea link, and it's called the Tuscar Tunnel. It's quite a distance separating the two land masses there, but it's you know, not at all beyond the possibilities now in terms of technology and so forth. So, I mean, if we had that completed, and we would also like to see, obviously, a continuation of that kind of rail network throughout Ireland, really to connect up all the major towns and cities. But it would facilitate, you know, shipping cargo, freight, arriving at Shannon and being transported by high-speed rail right across through Wales and England, across the Channel Tunnel, then into France and into the heart of Europe. And we think that's, you know, a very feasible proposal, and something that should be looked at, you know, very seriously in the even in the months and years ahead, certainly.
Right. And, if you look at the distances themselves, it's not a question of distance. It's the higher organization, the tunnels and the rail connections, right? And it would transform. One thing, because I want to ask you about the latest strategic fights, you know, get into that. We have in the remaining half hour. But back to the landscape that would be completely changed. There was a point in the 20th century, I guess, when the Shannon estuary area that you're talking about, there was a kind of power system, a kind of upgrade proposal. You mentioned it as the Shannon scheme that you said Franklin Delano Roosevelt was familiar with, that on a much smaller scale has the very same idea of the larger scale Tennessee Valley Authority. Do you want to just say anything about that Shannon scheme?
Well, the Shannon scheme was a concept developed to basically electrify Ireland in the 20s, and it was quite a bold proposal at the time. The German company Siemens, you know, came over to, you know, to assist and direct the actual construction, and actually it caught the eye. The whole scheme caught the eye of Franklin Roosevelt while he was, I think, mayor of New York. And he later incorporated, you know, that kind of, you know, strategic infrastructure policy when he, you know, proposed the Tennessee Valley Authority. So, you know, that was a great achievement of the early Irish state, as it was, you know, just really founded a couple of years earlier in 1921. So, but since that time, unfortunately, such schemes have not been put forward, have been suppressed, you know, for all sorts of reasons. Of course, when you're operating within a monetary system, it's always the question of money. How can we afford this, you know, and who's going to pay for this and so forth? But, you know, obviously we need to look towards a credit system, an American-style credit system, and that will enable us to pursue, you know, the projects that we have in mind and that Ireland need to build up its economy, to reach a new platform of economy in terms of high-speed rail, but also nuclear power, which we think is essential. At the minute, for example, our economy is powered by peat.
Yeah, you're impressive, all right. But, I mean, I think, again, if people look at the map, the history of Ireland geomorphologically and geologically is amazing, because you have this ancient rock, pre-Cambrian. Cambria rocks used to be named after where they were found, and that's Wales, of course, that has ancient rock, hence Cambria. But then you had all these successive glaciation and the development of these peat bogs. But on the other hand, as you said, it's retrograde right now.
Well, I mean, it's really unfortunate that, you know, if you ask the average Irish person, you know, do they want to have a nice holiday in France, you know, they will jump on the first plane and, you know, happily wander and travel around France amidst, I think it's 59 nuclear power plants that they have in France. You know, the power of the country, and you know, there's no trepidation or no worry at all expressed, but the very mention of the possibility of a nuclear reactor in Ireland, you know, is enough to send some people into hysterics, and you know, it makes absolutely no sense at all. It's the direction we need to take. France is the nearest and probably the best example of what we can achieve in Ireland if we, you know, just open our minds to the possibilities of nuclear power. I mean, France derives, I think, 75%, maybe 80% of its power from nuclear plants. And, of course, you know, we're at a point where we have fourth generation nuclear plants, which are, you know, extremely safe and extremely efficient, and also the fact we have significant deposits of uranium and thorium in Ireland, you know, to fuel such a development in terms of nuclear power. So I think, you know, the reasons, you know, really stack up in favour of nuclear power and, you know, technological development in general. Unfortunately, we have the problem that everyone else throughout the world seems to have, throughout the Western world in particular, I suppose, which is environmentalism. And we had the misfortune to have a green minister as minister for the environment recently in Ireland, even though the Greens only received a 2% of the vote. The nature of the coalition government,
they got that thing, portfolio, and
they got that portfolio, and while he was there and had that position, he basically slapped a ban on not only exploitation and mining of uranium and thorium, anything like that, but an actual ban on the even looking for these deposits or,
mapping them.
Yes, any of that was totally banned. Mm. And of course, the Greens were dispatched from government, and you know that their vote, their paltry 2% vote, collapsed to zero, I think, in the last election. But you know, the damage had been done, by this guy Ran during his tenure, his short tenure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just very, very unfortunate that the Greens have this influence, you know, beyond their relatively small size. Their, you know, the hardcore Green movement is quite small, but I think people have a natural tendency to have concerns about the environment. I think it is the most natural thing in the world, but I think it's important that each individual, is honest and rigorous in their, in their analysis of these points, and simply not leave it to, what they're told, what mainstream popular opinion is, because, what the Greens are trying to do is just, it really is anti-human, and it's totally irrational as well. You know, people have to ask themselves, how can we support a population in the world of 7 billion people and growing on solar power and wind power? You know, it simply doesn't make any sense. And once you understand that, I think you have to look at the intention behind such policies, and I think once you do that, people will come to the understanding that this environmentalism is totally anti-human, and in fact genocidal, and would reject it totally on that basis.
Yeah, we got an expression of just what you say. We don't have to take time to discuss it. By Obama on Thursday in New Hampshire at a Nashua Community College, gave an energy speech for 25 minutes, and it was just a study in what you described, the intent behind the concept, where he said, our energy policy must be all of the above, meaning solar, wind, corn ethanol. Nuclear can come down with a small n at the very last, because that's a way that people's gullibility is played upon, all of the above. And of course the intent is people will die, because none of this can support and can't get us to, you can't go underneath the threshold of progress through the ages. And also let me just ask you one thing and then we move on. This tremendous, whatever you call it, the continental shelf or the great marine area offshore of Ireland, just our guest last week on the LaRue Show was from Australia, and he said the greenyism there, among the many terrible things that are being perpetrated, is they've locked up a lot of the offshore part of that huge island nation of Australia in what they call MRAs, I think it's called Marine Reserve Areas or something, meaning they are untouchable for anything. I hope that isn't underway in Ireland, but of course the greenies internationally are trying, right?
I'm sure they would love to implement that kind of policy. As far as I'm aware, it hasn't been done so far, but I'm sure they're trying their damnedest to achieve that, and hopefully reason will prevail and it won't be allowed to happen.
Well, it's our fight and what we have to clean up. As you said, this ban on the mining or mapping of uranium is still, all this has to be cleaned up. That brings me around. Let me ask you this. I know you have on your website, and remember, people listening, just do a search and you'll find under LaRouche Irish Brigade, the right website, and in which there is a sense, I think there may be an explicit mission or discussion of the mission for United Ireland. I think you used the expression free from bailouts, austerity, and the corpse of the British Empire's dying system, its monetarism. And in that sense, Ireland is kind of a world-class point of expression of resistance right now in the Eurozone. I'm not confining it to the Eurozone because of the fight underway between the perspective you have just outlined about the developments on Earth and how we can lift off into space, if that's all one. You have that versus those saying, no, you have to have austerity to the death. Literally, you have to have more financial bailouts for the few fat mega banks, part of the dying British system, British Empire system. So let me ask you, would you just some, in other words, the, when I say Ireland is resisting, you said some recent developments have occurred. Can you just describe them about a referendum that's going to come up? Or
Yes, the so-called austerity treaty that the Troika, as we know them as
for all of Europe, right?
Yeah.
Let me give you the title. I have it here, Eugene. Sure. I didn't mean because it's in Empire Speak, and you're right. You call it, it's called Treaty for Stability, Coordination, and Governance in the Economic and Monetary Union. I think it was proposed January and then signed on to March 1st. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just listen to the title. It sounds great, doesn't it? You know.
Yes, coordination and governance. Who could object?
Coordination and governance, but also, you know, notably, it's the reference to instability or to stability. In other words, you know, if we reject this, we're looking at instability.
Yeah, but you're troublemakers that should be shot. Probably that's what's.
Yeah. But yeah, so we have managed to secure a referendum on this treaty, austerity treaty, as it's called, and we're very happy about that, because you know we think that you know the way the population has been treated by the Troika, with the misery and the austerity that's already been imposed. You know, we think that this the population would certainly reject that treaty, and that would be a very important development for not just for Ireland, but for all of Europe,
for all the world. I think
for all the world.
Yeah,
we hope that it would bring the final curtain down on this Euro debacle, and we look forward to a no vote in that referendum.
Right, and everybody knows what the many people listen to this show regularly. That's a very good thing, and activate on it. But the Troika is the European Central Bank, the European Union Commission, and the IMF. Did I get it right?
Yes.
Okay. And these are like the combination in the United States of the White House, the IMF, and the City of London, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're the in my opinion, the face of a modern fascism in Europe, and you know, somebody put it recently. Actually, somebody on the BBC, maybe some couple of years ago, that you know what they were trying to achieve, what the fascists were trying to achieve in Europe through war, in the 40s, they are now trying to achieve through stealth and, you know, political means and so forth. So I think it really should be clear to most people the nature of this this Euro system, you know, that it is fascist. You know, you just have to look at what has been done already in Greece.
Yes.
In Italy, you know, where democratic governments have been really just usurped by, you know, these banksters, as we tend to refer to them. And, you know, I have heard recently a rumor about Ireland that something similar, you know, was being considered. Now, as I say, it's just a rumor, but it's one that certainly made me gasp, you know, when they talked about a certain character called Peter Sutherland, who was former Goldman Sachs executive and EU commissioner, that he may head up, you know, such a government in Ireland, totally unelected. So, I mean, what has been pushed by these people, this troika, I think, you know, must be firmly rejected by the citizens. The only fear is that, of course, they will use all the scare tactics available to them. You know, fear that the money will dry up, mm-hmm. that, you know, people will be plunged into isolation and poverty and so forth. And I think a very important part of our job is really to explain to people that there is a different system, you know, from monetarism in the shape of American system, economics, and credit system. And that's what we'll be working very hard to promote on the website and elsewhere in the coming months up to the election, referendum.
Great. Yeah, because the mechanics of this aren't the issue. I mean, but this, if you look at the photographs of all 25 heads of state, March 1st, just 2 days ago, signing on to this kind of set of orders where you can't do this, you can't and you have to submit to non-national governance, so-called, and if you don't do it, you'll be cut off from what? By 2013, and 12 of 25 nations all have to agree in it. But it's all for the immediate day-to-day imposition of fierce impoverishment, like you've seen in Greece, to the point of disease, early death. Do you want to say just a couple things people don't know in Ireland, just in the last few years of preliminary compliance with the kind of bailout, you know, alignment? People's there's been cutbacks and undercutting of people's means of existence. You want to say anything about that?
Yes, well, I mean, I think the statistic that speaks loudest is the fact, something that's been published recently, and that is that Ireland has a higher suicide rate than even Greece. You know, and I think there's nothing needs to be added to that, you know, to that kind of fact. It's absolutely shocking. And, you know, as I say, if people can't see that emanates directly from these policies of the Troika and this Euro-fascism, you know, I don't know if I would... I don't know what can be done to alert people. I mean, the problem is that in Ireland, the way the whole EU was sold, the euro and so forth, it was basically promoted as a way for Ireland to essentially escape the clutches of perfidious Albion, as we refer to the British.
Yes, it is widespread, deserved. Yeah. Moniker, but go right ahead.
Yes. So, you know, and people still tend to believe that, you know, and that's why there has been quite a, you know, traditionally quite a strong support and quite a strong leaning towards Europe and the euro system and so forth. You know, that people saw it as an escape route from British centuries of British domination. But of course, you know, it's far from the case. And
I remember one thing over the years, and in talking to certain people in Ireland who were in the farm sector, it was also sold as you can get out from under the City of London and you can have a new way to decent prosperity for the dairy and cheese export sector, for the real estate sector. All this going along with what you said, cut off your nose to spite your face.
Yes, you know, exactly. It's it was sold in that way. It's just a complete deception because it is, you know, a financial system. It's controlled, you know, by the financial empire and the seat of power there is the City of London. People tend to make the mistake that it's France or Germany that are bullying Ireland and Greece and Italy and the so-called pigs nations, as they so kindly refer to us. But people tend to blame Germany and France for that, which is, you know, an absolute you know, mistake. It is being run from London, and I mean, the notions of federal Europe were proposed, you know, many years ago by, actually, I think, going right back to the late 50s by Oswald Mosley, the famous British fascist.
English fascist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think, as I say, the referendum is coming up, and there Sinn Féin, other parties, there's a grouping called the United Left Alliance,
mm-hmm.
Led by a politician called Joe Higgins,
mm-hmm.
and they are vociferously opposed to this austerity treaty. I think already we have begun to see, you know, certain ructions in the political establishment and in the main political parties. Recently, just the other day, in fact, Eamon O'Keefe, who was the vice, the deputy leader of the Fianna Fáil party,
mm-hmm.
Split from the party or stepped down from his position, you know, in objection to the Fianna Fáil, the direction they were taking in favour of this austerity treaty. So I think we'll probably see more of that kind of thing in the weeks and days and weeks ahead, right up to the referendum. So I think, you know, it's really all to be played for. I think the people, if they were aware of, you know, what was in the design of this austerity treaty, they would reject it immediately. But we have to make sure that those that have been duped and, you know, continue to be duped, are, you know, we have to help them to see through that smokescreen.
Right. Well, I think just what you were saying before, with your whole setup, the website, but I mean the policy initiative, pumping this out now in midst of this tumult, the potential is tremendous for, as you say, relieving people of their delusions. And I know if you step back, you think Ireland, of all places in the world, which has been almost synonymous with spiritual inspiration for republicanism through everything, culture, music, and so. But in the past, what a lot of people don't know, how, and you're saying maybe some of your countrymen, how the economic policy was an integral part of Ireland becoming the Republic of Ireland, like Arthur Griffith, in the who was the great figure. His dates are 1872, I think, to 1922. One of the, let's call it, the founding fathers of the Free Republic of Ireland. But economic understanding of economic development as the nature of man was what. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's very significant, I think, that Arthur Griffiths, you know, who is actually the, you know, the father, I suppose, of the Irish nation, in a way, that he proposed as early as 1905, you know, these ideas of, you know, the American system and physical economy, and, you know, he made extensive proposals for that. Arthur Griffiths was the founder as well of the Sinn Féin Party, and it was actually the Sinn Féin Party, the initial Republican Party, that all the, you know, the other parties that we have today evolved from, you know. So we have Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin itself, the Labour Party, all sprang initially from that core Republican Party. But as I say, the unfortunate thing is that Arthur Griffiths himself has practically been airbrushed out of people's consciousness in Ireland, and certainly his ideas of physical economy just have been totally neglected. I mean, they were proposed at a later, slightly later date by Michael Collins himself,
mm-hmm.
You know, the great freedom fighter and hero of Ireland. But, I mean, since Collins' time, they have been totally neglected. But I think that's just a fair indication of of how fearful the British and this British Empire are of economic development, and you know that the fact that they have suppressed it and tried to suppress it and managed, of course, to suppress it over all these decades since, that is an indication of how important really it is to the nation of Ireland, to have those policies in place, as they look towards reunification and total independence and sovereignty from the British Empire, which, as you mentioned earlier, has been a dominant factor in the life of people in Ireland for 800 years.
Right, and on the flip side, same point you're making, you get people may have people at large, some people who are relatively informed may know about the terrible time of the Irish potato famine, but what people don't put together, this was the policy. This is the policy of the new stability pact of the Eurozone, to create conditions where people will die. And, you know, at the minimum, you create the situation of people in complete poverty trying to grow their own few potatoes to exist, and so, and then reality intervenes, a blight occurs. This is the policy we're fighting against. And in that sense, you'd think everyone, all your compatriots in Ireland, would know that it's the Empire. But you're saying there are only certain moments it wells up. I think one of them was in your own life. You had the original attempt by the London Empire royal types to go into the Americas and stage a confrontation over the Malvinas Islands that they insist on calling the Falklands. And yes, you did get a reaction. You did scratch an Irishman. You got a good reaction. But yeah, Now it's a question of making this informed.
Yes, I mean, the Ireland, for centuries has, I think, had this this republican tradition, and this this leaning towards republicanism. And that's totally understandable given what the British have done, to the country over all these years. I mean, the famine, as you mentioned, is just, such a clear example of the actual contempt for human life.
Yeah, millions left, 3 million left, 3 million died, or is it, no?
Yeah, I mean, it's there are various figures offered. Some recent research has suggested, it has basically revived the census figures that were available from the time. The census figure stated 8 million people or almost 9 million people were living in Ireland at the before the famine. That has been revised, as I say, by these new figures issued, which suggest 12 million people
in the early 1840s were living, and then
And then the famine struck, through the following decade, during which I think the population basically halved. And as you know, and most of the people in America here know, there was a desperate scramble for those lucky enough to be able to get onto ships and try and escape to the New World. But having said that, it wasn't a straightforward operation, because the ships were, for example, were called coffin ships, were referred to as coffin ships, and before the people boarded the ships, the tradition was to have a wake for them at home. In other words, that they basically, their families weren't expecting, either that they would survive the journey, which many of them didn't, or that if they did survive it somehow and make it to America, that they wouldn't, be seen again. So really, tragic times. And the important thing to remember, I think, for people that feel in a certain way detached from history, they think anything before World War II, as I used to, is really, so far in the past that it's not worth worrying about. But if you think of it in terms of, if you take a man like just for example, Lyndon LaRouche, who was approaching 90 years of age. You know, the Irish famine happening in the 1940s is well within two lifetimes of, you know, someone of Lyndon LaRouche's age. You know, so it is, when you look at it in those terms, you know, it is not long ago at all. And, you know, we tend to fool ourselves as well into believing that these horrors that have happened in the past, whether it be famine in Ireland or India, in fact, which suffered greatly in the same way, or World War II, you know, we tend to think that these things can never be repeated. But as you mentioned, there are the policies of austerity and what this Troika is proposing at the minute seem to be, you know, heading again down that terrible route. So we have to, we just have to be aware of that, you know.
Yes, and I'm afraid we've run out of time. But on that note of being aware of it and acting to stop it, that is our theme today, this day of March 3rd, 2012. And I'm so glad Jean Douglas from Ireland, from the LaRouche Irish Brigade, from this international effort, could be here with us. I will say, he gave greetings to the February 25th-26th conference in Berlin. We didn't discuss this more, but you can find out about the presentations at that conference, including his. Make sure you have your subscription to EIR online. You know, it's LaRouchePub.com. And get hour-by-hour sense of what of organizing tasks and updates from LaRouchePack.com. And be sure we'll be back again next week. And watch LaRouchePack.com. I think Mr. LaRouche may be involved in evaluating and addressing the world situation sometime in the next 10 days. It could be even March 10th on Saturday. Make sure and watch for that. But I want to thank you again, Gene, so much. This will be the end of March 3rd, 2012. Thanks.
You're welcome, Marcia. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.